Hallelujah. Guys are sounding good this morning. Well, that's my prayer, is that I could be a blessing to someone today. One person's all I'm looking for, a blessing to one person. Bob offered to introduce me. I'll just say this much. I'm here by the grace of God and Bob Dugan. I came to Boulder Men's Christian Fellowship on July 21st of 2005. And my goal that day was to get Bob and Jim Messmer off my back. We moved in to McKinley Drive just a few blocks from here, and within a year, Bob was on me. And took 10 years. So that's not a Bob problem, that's a Dennis problem. So I came on that morning, and two things occurred to me. One was I had missed the boat for a long time, and two, this is the house that God built, and you are the men that God created. So to be clear, before I say anything else this morning, I'm here because of the grace of God. So I've got a I'm going to attempt to do this in one session. I don't think I'll need seven sessions. Most of you guys know me pretty well by now. I'll do a brief history of the Paul family, talk a little bit about my youth, and then spend a couple minutes on college and Deborah, and hit a little bit on my career. Actually, there's six things. I hope I can do this. What I believe, and then what the future holds. But the opportunities I've been given in my life are unbelievable. I'm a man that sits and wonders a lot about how God has blessed me, or more importantly, why God has blessed me so richly, because I've lived a blessed life. I've also lived a life where the church was very prevalent. My mom saw to that, and my left ear paid the price, because come Sunday morning, I was coming, hell or high water, to church. So I was born in 1960 to Fred and Dorothy. Those were my parents. Talk about them in just a minute. But the Paul family, my grandparents on my father's side immigrated to Edmonton, Canada in 1915 from Vienna, Austria. And they were both born and raised there. I was in Vienna 2 years ago. We went on a little bit of a quest to maybe find a little history. We weren't able to. That's a big city, and you need some time to do that, and I didn't do enough research. But they went to Edmonton, Canada, and ended up coming down to Steamboat in 1920. My grandfather was a coal miner, and he met his demise in the coal mines. It was called the American Standard Mine. Anyway, my dad and my uncle were born in Steamboat. However, they didn't stay there. My grandmother took them to Paonia, Colorado, and that's where my dad and my uncle were raised until they were 18, and then they went into the service. As far as my mom's side, that was the Klink family. My grandparents immigrated from the Holstein region of Germany, that's northeastern Germany, and ended up in Graham County, Kansas, which is western Kansas. There's not a lot there. It's all dryland wheat. They were farmers. My grandfather was the county commissioner for Graham County during the Depression era. And the stories I had heard were that the USDA and the federal folks would bring foodstuffs to their house, and then they'd distribute it to the county. My mom moved to Denver in 1952, and then my father got out of the service and moved to Denver. So my uncle went right back to the Western Slope, and he lived the rest of his life in Salida, working for the Colorado Game and Fish Department. He had virtually no use for the city. He was a mountain man, He was. I always liked to spend time over there. He was did what's called the rendezvous. That's where you dress up in period clothing. It's kind of like Civil War, but I think it's even goes back further than that. This must be Warren. Good morning, Warren. Come on in. We'll find you a seat. Let's find you a seat. Anyway, I always dug it because he let me shoot his musket and his firearms, and he never came. He came east very seldom. He saw my grandmother a couple times a year. My dad moved my grandma to Denver, and one of my fond memories was every Saturday morning we'd get up early, he and I, like at 7, and drive to Denver to see her. She lived right off of Pearl and Colfax, just behind the cathedral there. So the doctors told my mom and dad they couldn't get pregnant. So that was in 1953. And then in 1960, my mom got pregnant. And they still scratching their head on that one. But she liked to call it the Immaculate Conception. I think that's a stretch. you think? Anyway, I was born and my dad at that time had told my mom, Dorothy, we're going to move to Boulder. And she thought that was the craziest thing she'd ever heard. She couldn't get her arms around that. She worked as a beauty salon person, a beautician down on Colfax. They went to church at a church called Calvary Temple. Some of you might remember that. That was Charles Blair. That goes back a long, long way. It was a very prominent church in the Cherry Creek area. My mom grew up as that was a very Pentecostal family. As you know, I grew up in the Assemblies of God Church, very charismatic church. I wanted to sit down, and I couldn't sit down. My mom wouldn't let me sit down. Those are fond memories. My father, on the other hand, grew up as a Catholic. My grandmother went to Mass every day at the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception. But when my dad and mom got together, my mom put an end to his Catholicism in a very matter-of-fact way. So that was a one-sided discussion. So they came to Boulder, and they went to Boulder Valley Assembly of God from a young age. And that's the church I grew up in. Of all of the years that I've been in Boulder, and it's been a long time, I've only gone to two churches. So I grew up in that church. Deborah and I got married in that church. And on our wedding night, my mom said that if I don't see anything else in my life, I've seen what I need to see. So for us to get married in the AOG was something that meant a lot to her. I was an only child of older parents. My dad was 36. My dad was 38. My mom was 36. And I was the centerpiece of their universe. And I point that out just by virtue of the fact that everything revolved around me. You know, Rick, I think about your story. Rick and I grew up together in Boulder. We went to KC together in Boulder High. My parents were super engaged, super involved. And it's a blessing in retrospect. It was a little interesting at the time. I couldn't really pull a lot of wool over their eyes because we were always together. So we were a family unit. And my dad used to always say, I want to make sure you have everything that I didn't have. So again, the theme here is blessings. I lived such a blessed life that I just can't believe it. To this day, I just want to throw myself on the ground and say, Lord. So I gave myself to God in 1993 at the AOG. A couple that were very instrumental in that was Ken and Pat Cook. Their son, Tim Cook, and I grew up together. We went to Washington Elementary and KC together and then on to Boulder High. But the Cooks, they were at Calvary. And they were incredibly influential on my life. And I owe them a lot in terms of my walk with Jesus. They lived on Washington and 14th, and I was there every day. Tim and I always had projects going in the backyard. And Pat and Ken were just, they were just humble people. One thing about my youth that that was a marquee aspect of it was fear the Lord. So when you're in the AOG or in a Pentecostal church, that's a very strong message. I never understood that. Was I supposed to be scared to death, or how was that supposed to work? But fear the Lord was a big theme. The other thing that was an interesting theme was because I was the centerpiece of my parents' life, I got a lot. So when it came time for Christmas and birthdays, it was big. So on Elder, as Dale will recall, we had a shed full of motorcycles, go-karts, pinball machines. We had a carport, and my dad put up an indoor basketball court. And so our house was the center of attention. The Gondersecks and the Gallaghers, we played basketball in there into the night because he had it lit. So, yeah, it was kind of a cool scene. But one thing that my father said all the time, he's like, don't brag. Oh, he used to say that so much. And be humble. And when we put him in the ground, Tom Shirk buried him in 2005. That was something that everybody talked about, was his humility and the fact that he never bragged. And he expected that out of me. My folks were old school. They ruled. So although I had it all, I also had to toe the line for sure. So my dad wasn't adverse to shutting me down at any given time. We had a bathroom in our house that had two doors. So you could essentially, there was a circuit. So you come out of the bathroom, you go through the living room, dining room, into the kitchen, and back to the bathroom. There were a number of times when he would chase me, and we'd be doing laps, and that was interesting. So anyway, you know, I think about the first 20 years of my life. Well, I think about them as being unbelievable. How much. I was blessed, and I just thank God that I had accountability too. So that was something that was important. So the other thing that was interesting is I went off to college. So my father worked at CU for 27 years. He was in the physical plant. He wasn't on faculty. He was staff, and his dream, of course, was for me to go to CU. And we had no college graduates. We had one college graduate back to my grandparents. That was my grandfather. But I was considered a first-generation scholar. And what was interesting about that was I didn't have a damn clue. So I didn't have a household where my folks, you know, told me, kind of set me up for success. Not that they didn't want to. It's just that they didn't have the capacity to do it. So I took off gung-ho. Up to CU, my mom was like, boy, this is going to be awesome. You can live at home, and you can ride your bike up and have lunch with your father every day. And she said that with a straight face. And I was 18, and I was getting a little anxious to check out the world. The problem was I didn't know what I was doing, so I got up there, I took some classes, and I immediately crashed and flunked out. So I made it through fall semester. I did not make it through spring semester. And I didn't know what the heck was going on. I was literally green as a gourd. So during this time, I had tons of love from my family. I had Jesus in my life. But I was clueless. So I actually went down to the community college and took two accounting classes just because I didn't have there was no way I could pass accounting. I just didn't. I didn't have the study ethic or anything like that. I suppose I had some gray matter, but I just didn't know about it, or I didn't leverage it. So being a first generation scholar, in retrospect, I think about that, and I think about I missed a lot. I mean, no crisis, no setbacks, but I did miss a lot because I didn't know what I was doing. One of the things I do at Elevations, I've started a foundation, Elevations Foundation in 2010, and one of the things we do is scholarship. You know, we were the UFC Federal Credit Union, so scholarship's important to us, is to spend time with our first generation scholars and make sure they get pre-collegiate programming. So when you give a first generation scholar scholarship and they've not had any pre-collegiate programming, 9 out of 10 of them fall flat on their faces. I'm one of them. If they had pre-collegiate programming, and there's a number of programs available to them, 8 out of 10 graduate within 5 years. And this is so important because these are folks that could positively impact the world around them given the opportunity. That's a little departure from my script. So anyway, I regrouped. My parents wanted me to have a degree. They're like, "My God, you're gonna get a degree if it takes 6 years." And actually, it took 6 years. So that fall of 1980, a bunch of my buddies from Boulder High had gone to CSU. So, and at that point, my folks were starting to. The luster of me being around all the time was starting to wane a little bit. So I went to CSU that fall. And that was fall of 80. And in the dorms in Braden Hall up there, I met Deborah. So I went there and I got a wife. I did get a degree, but that's secondary. So anyway, so I made it through CSU. I actually thrived the last few couple years. Those first couple were tricky. I got my finance degree and my economics degree. And I don't know why I got those degrees, because I didn't know what I was doing, but I ended up getting them. So in 1980, Deborah and I met, and we started dating. And she had actually graduated in 83 and had an internship in Seattle, so she left. And we kind of parted ways, and that was fine. We had kept in touch. So anyway, I got my degree. I immediately went into banking. I went out and bought a bunch of suits, white shirts, silk ties, and braces. So button-in suspenders, and I went down there to 17th in California and worked at IntraWest Bank, and I thought I was the man. I looked good. I had a briefcase too. And my father looked at me and he goes, "Yeah, you're not the man. You're a credit analyst." So what I did was I put together folders for the man, and the man got all the credit, and I put together the folders. Anyway, I did that for a few years. And it was kind of fun, kind of a novelty, being in the big city and acting like the man. But then Deborah had other plans. So she and we had stayed in touch and stayed together a little bit. And in 1989, so she had gone back to Omaha. She was a clinician at the University of Nebraska Med Center. She went back home because her father was in a situation where he was struggling with a long-term cancer diagnosis. They were very close. She was super close to her father. And he passed away. I want to say she was about 24, 25. And she called me one night. I was living up in Table Mesa. I bought a little condo off of Bear Mountain Drive. Once again, thinking I was the man, but I wasn't the man. God saw to that, thank goodness. So she called me and she goes, "I'm moving to Boulder. I got a job with a Vista hospital." She was a charter employee, meaning one of their first employees. I didn't know what to say. There was a little silence on the phone, and I said, and I was dating at the time, and I said, "You know, that's great. That's exciting. Don't do it on my account." Anyway, within 6 months, she'd moved back. She'd moved my roommates out and remodeled our kitchen in mauve and white. And I didn't even know what was going on. I was so dang clueless. So about a year and a half later, she gave me a date and a time and a location and said, don't mess this up. So that's how the proposal went. It was a mandate from her to me. Anyway, at that point, I was actually 30, and my career was very important to me. I was climbing the ladder, and but it was obviously we didn't have the dating apps back then, so you had to work for it back then. You had to go out and meet folks. And God, you know, God is good, and he'd give me a little kick in the butt once in a while, and I prayed a lot about it, and my parents prayed about it, and they said, you better not screw this one. The whole message was, don't screw this up. I think that was God's message. That was my folks' message. It was certainly Deborah's message. So anyway, so we got married in June of 92. She got pregnant that September, and 6 months into her pregnancy, she was told she was having twins. And so we didn't, you know, we hadn't planned for that. I certainly hadn't planned for that. thank God she's a neonatal specialist, because I didn't have to do a lot. But so the twins came 3 weeks before our first anniversary, and it was another one of those moments where I said, how can you bless me so richly? God gave us a boy and a girl, and they were everything. I mean, the pregnancy was smooth. Deborah got a little cranky toward the end. She went up to 200 pounds. If you repeat that, I'll deny it. By the way, I'll deny ever saying that. So at that point, I'm continuously saying God. So at that point in my life, I felt very unworthy of it. So I had to pray about it. I talked to Tom Shirk a lot about it. We used to talk almost weekly. He's a pastor up at Calvary. And at that time, Deborah had a colleague that's name was, he was Bob Bucknam. He's a doctor out at Avista. Bob knows him. He built a house for him and Gail. He had partnered with a gentleman and wrote a book called Growing Kids God's Way. And we ended up immersing ourselves in that and becoming coaches, actually. And the cool thing about this book is it makes it clear that the centerpiece of the household is the husband-wife relationship. It's not the kids. So the very internal circle is the husband-wife relationship, and you can't let anything penetrate that or detract from that. So the next rung, if you will, are the kids. Obviously, the kids are great, but they're not as great as the marriage and the husband-wife relationship. And then from there, the family, and then the friends and careers and things like that. Anyway, we were very blessed. Our kids were dedicated in the church, and both of them came to Christ in their teen years. I will say this much, Alex tested us, and every man in this room knows that. But he's a seeker, his sister's a seeker. So once again, what's the moral of the story? More blessings. It's unreal. It's simply amazing that a man like me would be blessed as richly as he is. So just on my career, you guys know I've had 25 years with my company. I've done every role in banking and finance, and I've moved now into government affairs. I'm a lobbyist for our industry. I work real closely with our trade industry. About 10 years into my career at Elevations, I started getting approached to do board work, boards and commissions. So one of the things that I've enjoyed is being on boards, and I think there's a future in that in retirement. But one of the boards I was involved with was you guys remember me talking about Second Wind Fund. It's a teen suicide prevention program in Boulder County. Alex asked me to be involved in that when he lost a good friend at Fairview. And that really shook him. And obviously, he ended up going on to become what's called a peer educator in the BVSD, where he went in and taught classroom work about it. He got very very involved in that, and he asked me to get involved. Anyway, from there, I went on to do boards. Currently, I sit on a couple boards. I chair the Boulder Chamber Board. I sit on a couple foundation boards. That's actually been more gratifying than banking. Banking, at the end of the day, where's Kerry at? He was a bank examiner. So you want to talk about a dynamic career. Kerry, you had it all, man. Yeah, you did. Ouch. Fortunately, our balance sheet smelled like roses. So anyway, I hope to retire the summer of 2025. Deborah has made a decision to retire as well. I never thought she would. Her career has been her life, and it's been a very meaningful career. She has pioneered protocols in the NICU that she teaches all over the world. We're going to be going to Tulum, France this fall, and she's going to present to neonatologists in Europe. But that industry, that sector took a beating during the pandemic. We lost a lot of, they lost a lot of institutional knowledge at Children's. They had about 40% turnover, and these clinicians are replaced by young guns coming out of school. They're solid, but they don't have they don't have the demeanor that it takes, according to Deborah. She was the one thing nice about our household. She was the business end of the horse, and I was the fun end. So I always used to say when the kids coughed, she wanted them airlifted to Children's. So I didn't have a lot to worry about. Let me shift gears here, and I'll just close on this. And by the way, thank you guys for coming this is a fun series. This was the brainchild of Albiniak. He said, if we don't have a speaker, we got a speaker, because there's 20 or 30 of us. So it's been really neat to hear this. And it's been the opportunity to be up here every Friday morning. And by the way, this is my 8th in a row. I wanted to get that out. And this is it, though. Unfortunately, next week I won't be here. So we're leaving for Mexico this afternoon. Deborah, once again, kind of mandated some beach time. So I've led a blessed life. My parents led me to Christ. We led our children to Christ. I don't know what else I could ask for. I do feel unworthy, and that kind of seeps into my life, especially when I ask you guys to pray about my faith. For some reason, I still have worry, and I don't like that, and I don't know why I do. So what I believe character is destiny. So I heard that was something that Teddy Roosevelt said in the book about his travels in the Amazon. So I wrote that on a little piece of paper and taped it on Alex's refrigerator in Iowa so he could see it every day. You could say it any way you want to say it, but that's the way I say it. Character is destiny. We'll ultimately reap what we sow. God will dictate all of that. There's nothing we can do about it except fall in place. So I've often thought about the fruit of the Spirit. I mentioned that passage last Friday. And that's kind of been a barometer for me. I read that scripture and I say, how do I stack up? Unfortunately, I don't stack up that well, but it's aspirational. So how do I do with love? I love because I was loved. I have joy because of God's blessings. I don't have peace. And I certainly, my patience was ripped out brutally by my children when they were in high school. So I'm working on patience. Kindness. This is a commentary on character. Goodness. I have the opportunity to be good because so many people have been good to me. Faithfulness, it's very seldom that I don't go an hour in my waking day without praying. In fact, I do that more than anything. So that's I got to get some gold stars for that, right? Gentleness, I could work on that. Deborah might suggest that I could be more gentle. And self-control. You know, I've often thought, which fruit is the most important? You know, in the Bible, there's never a reference to one being more important to the other. But I'll tell you, self-control is something that, as a man, I struggle with hugely. One of the things that's not in that scripture is surrender. So that's a word I've been, I think a lot about. I'm not sure I've done that. So what's the future hold? Like I said, we're going to try to retire in about a year and a month. We're going to try to retire together. I'll likely be involved with some boards and commissions. Maybe for the first time in my life, see what BSF has to offer. This could be my entire retirement. I've read it a couple times, and I still miss about 80% of the point. So between December 17th and the end of January, I lost three guys. We lost a couple guys. Gene Brown and Jim Messmer were huge losses. I'd known Jim for long before I came to men's group. He was also quite diligent about getting me here. And then I lost a guy named Bob Boscola. He's a guy I'd known for years. He was an Afghan Desert Storm veteran. At Jim's funeral, the gentleman from Grace Commons made a reference to David Brooks' book, Road to Character. And he talked about resume virtues versus eulogy virtues. So in life, I've thought a lot about my resume. Even though I've only had a couple jobs, I've been blessed. I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse. In 35 years, I had two jobs. But that's not to suggest I didn't keep looking at my resume and keep tweaking it just a little bit and adding something here. David Brooks would suggest that the individual that does that is missing the boat. Could you imagine a eulogy? I think about Gene. I think about Jim. I think about my friend Bob. And their eulogy was a resume-based eulogy. Wouldn't that be a weird, wouldn't that be odd? Every one of those eulogies were virtues-based. So Jim, oh my goodness, as a man that was bent on bringing people to Christ, Gene, as a man that his family respected and loved unconditionally, I could not get over his family at that service. And then my friend Bob Boscola, who had one goal in life, and that was to put everybody else first. So anyway, I'll close on that. I'm out of time. I'm usually the guy watching the time, but I sure love you guys, and love you so much. Thank you.